ألم ذلك في سائر البدن. All Muslim community, all faithful community are like one and the same body organ, so that if one body organs, senses ailment, other body organs feel the same. Find themselves in sympathy with that body organ. At the same time, it's indicated that, for example, you find that when there's a biological or medical problem in one's hand or, for example, leg, you find that we may experience fever. We may experience fever, and this fever in the whole body indicates that the whole body and other body organs haven't remained indifferent to a pain or to a problem in a certain body organ. The same holds true regarding Muslim communities and faithful communities, and all faithful people should be like this. Because of this, we find that in Islamic instructions, in Islamic moral instructions, it's indicated that all people should be cooperative with each other. And if someone has received any problem, others must have sympathy, not in words, but in deeds. Both verbal and practical sympathy with the person who has been afflicted. This is one of the senses of mutual cooperation and mutual integration in Muslim communities.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
In the limelight. Reversing greenhouse gas emissions trends would diminish extinction risks by more than 70%, researchers found. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Study warns only rapid action can prevent worst marine extinction in 250 million years more. Research published recently in the journal Science warns that runaway global warming driven by carbon dioxide emissions has put marine life at risk of the most catastrophic mass extinction since the Great Dying 250 million years ago, when 90% of all ocean species were wiped out. Using models of varying emission scenarios, Princeton University scientists Curtis Dodge and Justin Penn found that the continued burning of fossil fuels and business-as-usual global temperature increases are likely to result by 2,300 in mass extinctions of marine systems on par with past great extinctions. With accelerating greenhouse gas emissions, species losses from warming and oxygen depletion alone became comparable to current direct human impacts within a century and culminate in a mass extinction rivaling those in Earth's past. The researchers write, polar species are at highest risk of extinction, but local biological richness declines more in the tropics. While their findings are dire, Dodge and Penn go out of their way to emphasize that the new research should be a catalyst for rapid action, not despair. They write, reversing greenhouse gas emissions trends would diminish extinction risks by more than 70%, preserving marine biodiversity accumulated over the past 50 million years of evolutionary history. Speaking to the New York Times, Dodge and Penn explained that the decision to underscore the possibility of averting the most cataclysmic extinction scenario was an active one, leading to a last-minute change in the study's pre-publication headline, Marine Extinction Risks from Climate Warming. Dodge said, "We were about to send it in, and I thought, gee, it sounds like a little that only has the dark side of the result." The headline they ultimately landed on, Avoiding Ocean Mass Extinction from Climate Warming, centers the element of choice. If humanity acts swiftly to bring carbon emissions into line with the limits set out by the Paris Agreement, warming can be dramatically slowed and devastating marine life extinctions can be prevented. Dodge said, "Our choices have huge impacts." The barriers to the kind of sweeping global climate action that the scientific evidence demands remain immense, however, as the rich countries most responsible for planet warming emissions burn fossil fuels at a rate that spells disaster for the future. In 2021, ocean temperatures were the highest ever recorded for the kind consecutive year. Oceans have absorbed over 30% of the carbon dioxide emissions produced by human activity over the past two centuries and 90% of the excess heat. The consequences for marine life are immense. Only one study published earlier this year warned that by 2080, around 70% of the world's oceans could be suffocating from a lack of oxygen as a result of climate change, potentially impacting marine ecosystems worldwide. At the COP26 Climate Summit in Glasgow late last year, nations adopted a pact stressing the importance of protecting, conserving, and restoring natures and ecosystems, including marine ecosystems. But climate advocates were dismayed by how little concrete action the gathering spurred, given the enormous consequences of failing to slash carbon emissions worldwide. Malin Pinsky, a Rutgers University biologist, told the Washington Post that Dodge and Penn's research shows, if we're not careful, we are headed for a future that I think to all of us right now would look quite hellish. Pinsky added, it's a very important wake-up call.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question which is often asked. And that question is this, that we know that after the death of Uthman, when Imam Ali alayhi salam accepted the Islamic government and formally became the caliph of the Islamic world, he made the city of Kufa, which is currently a city in Iraq right now, to be the center and the capital of his empire. The question that arises is this. We know that in the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the city of Medina was the center of the Islamic world. This continued in the era of the caliphs. So Why was it that Imam Ali decided to change the capital of the Islamic world and the Islamic empire to the city of Kufa? In some of our previous sessions, we alluded to some of these, some of the reasons for this transference of power to the city of Kufa. Today, we're going to be alluding and pointing towards another one of the reasons for this. The city of Kufa was established during the era of the conquest of the Caliph Umar. And this city was filled with people who were expertise in war and in military tactics. And these people were, great fighters and great soldiers on the battlefield. In fact, according to some historical reports, the number of soldiers, you know, people who were actually soldiers or participants in the military were exceeded or were equal to 100,000 individuals. And these people were very, very staunch supporters of Imam Ali and were his followers and his Shia. In contrast to this, the city of Medina had lost its military function or its place in the Islamic world at that time. And we will shortly allude to why this is so. The people of Medina, it is true that they were the people who pressured Imam Ali into accepting the government after the death of Uthman. However, after he did, these people turned their backs on him. And a lot of people, they withdrew the bay'at of the allegiance that they had paid to him. Many of the inhabitants of Medina, and almost approximately the entire citizens of the city of Mecca, they had enmity towards Imam Ali. Right? There's a long historical discussion on why this is so, but we won't get into that. But this is attested to by the fact that when the army of Muawiyah, it attacked these cities under the leadership of his commander, Ibn Arta, right? These people quickly, right? They quickly submitted to this army, didn't show any resistance. And in fact, Abu Ayyub Ansari, who had been placed as the ruler of Medina, right? When the army of Muawiyah attacked, he simply just got up and he fled the city without showing any resistance, right? So this the inhabitants of Kufa were better, supporters of Imam Ali, and also they were braver and more militarily prepared to support the Imam, and that's why he chose Kufa as the city of his capital. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining why the city of Kufa was chosen by Imam Ali as the capital of his government. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Families of victims of a deadly United States military drone strike in Libya have filed a complaint against the Italian commander in charge of the naval station used to carry out the attack. Now, the Tuareg elders are also demanding that the United States military command in Africa, AFRICOM, apologizes for the deadly drone strike that targeted innocent civilians. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week, we are discussing one of the many war crimes committed by the United States and its allies in Libya, where some of the affected families have now taken legal action. We are asking, can these victims of U.S. impunity get justice? In the second part of our show today, we are discussing the worrying trend of Nigerian medical doctors leaving the country to work in Western countries. Now, this immigration is negatively impacting on the country's health system. Some experts say if medical brain drain worsens critical staff shortages in vulnerable regions, then it is unethical.
U.S. crimes in Libya. The families of the victims of a U.S. drone attack that claimed almost a dozen lives in Libya back in 2018 have filed a criminal complaint against the commander of the Italian naval station for his role in carrying out the deadly strike. The Tuareg community, with the help of three human rights groups, filed the criminal complaint early April. The Italian commander of Naval Air Station Sigonella is facing accusations of unlawful use of force under both international and Italian domestic law.
The complaint called on public prosecutor's office in Siracusa, Sicily, to prosecute the commander at the U.S. airbase on the Italian island and other Italian officials involved in the attack. Now, the killing of innocent civilians by U.S. forces in Libya isn't unique. Similar incidents have been reported in other parts of Africa, particularly Somalia. The United States has been conducting illegal drone airstrikes in many Muslim countries under the pretext of countering terrorism, resulting in the deaths of thousands of civilians. Now, for more on these illegal U.S. drone strikes, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. Osazua, our first question to you. What is the significance of this suit filed by these Tuareg families against the Italian commander who ordered this drone strike?
Well, this lawsuit is not unique. The U.S. military, through AFRICOM, has killed innocent civilians countless times in Africa and the so-called Middle East with its drone strikes. And the families of those victimized and killed by the U.S. military have brought suits against AFRICOM and other facets and partners of U.S. imperialism in many cases, right? And AFRICOM and its partners, including Italy in this case, right, like the Italian commander, and folks like France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and others, in similar cases, have largely escaped any consequences for their actions. They usually are not found guilty in suits such as these. So I think it speaks to the general impunity of, you know, Western imperialism, Western militarism, and, you know, Western crimes against humanity on the African continent and elsewhere, including the so-called Middle East and Latin America.
The case seeking justice for Tuareg victims of the illegal U.S. drone strike has been filed by three human rights groups, namely Rete Italiana Pace e Disarmo, Reprieve, and the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights.
Jennifer Gibson, who leads Reprieve's work for Lethal Force, said the families wanted answers for the deadly attack that was carried out by a U.S. drone launched from Italian soil. Now, Mr. Osazua, what is the likelihood of these lawsuits succeeding, and can we foresee justice for the victims?
Well, it's interesting that the families chose to target the Italian commander. Like I said, that is not unique, but I believe that it may increase the family's likelihood of success, as they're not going up directly against the U.S. military, which is the force that is carrying out, you know, the will of the imperialist system, the main force, with its violence and devastation. However, I still believe that chance of victory for the families here to be relatively small. Similar suits have been filed and complaints, things like those have failed, including, you know, recently the targeting of German officers for the support of drone strikes in places like Yemen and Somalia. So, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but and that these families get some relief in the form of monetary support. But even if they were to get that kind of relief, the money doesn't bring back, or the victory in the suit doesn't bring back their killed family members.
In January this year, dozens of U.S. Congress members sent a letter to U.S. President Joe Biden asking for the review and overhaul of existing counterterrorism policy. The letter revealed that at least 48,000 civilians in seven countries were killed by the U.S. airstrikes in the course of the past two decades. The report added that as many as 2,200 civilians, including 450 children, lost their lives during attacks by at least 14,000 U.S. drone airstrikes since 2002. The U.S. military admitted that a drone strike in August last year killed as many as 10 civilians, including seven children in Afghanistan. The people of Afghanistan are demanding justice for the victims.
First of all, the Americans should not carry out attacks in a residential area, even if there were criminals there. And after they have carried out the attack, the problem cannot be solved with an apology. They should come and compensate the victims because the Afghan people are in poverty. Thus, a normal apology to those who have been harmed and lost their families is not enough.
What is the reason for such impunity enjoyed by U.S. forces in Africa and other parts of the world?
The U.S. military, or Department of Defense, and AFRICOM operate under the paradigm of innocent civilians versus enemy combatants. So U.S. President, or former U.S. President George W. Bush, you know, first used the enemy combatant framework following 9/11. 9/11 kicked off this war on terror, which has really been a reign of terror for many in the global South. But essentially, these enemy combatants are denied due process and are subjected to torture, including things like death, right? And these are immoral actions that are counter to international law and the Geneva Conventions. And so today, AFRICOM is able to declare anyone an enemy combatant, regardless of whether they are, you know, innocent civilians or who the U.S. claims to be targeting. And so this allows the U.S. and AFRICOM to escape any possible consequences. And due to U.S. imperialism and full spectrum dominance over the entire world, really, these crimes against humanity go unpunished.
The U.S. military forces are in Africa under the pretext of combating terrorism. However, after years of military presence in Africa, the U.S. has failed to eliminate extremists and terrorists. Now, according to the 2022 Global Terrorism Index, sub-Saharan Africa accounted for 48% of total global deaths from terrorism. Now, Mr. Osazuwa, what is the U.S. exactly doing in Africa where it says it wants to eliminate terrorist groups, but we have seen an upsurge of terrorist attacks in the continent?
Yes, well, you know, the U.S. military through AFRICOM, right, formalizes its presence in Africa with better coordination and strategic focus for realizing the long-term goals of, and geopolitical goals, rather, of U.S. imperialism. And so, you know, AFRICOM and the military's purpose isn't really fighting terrorism. Like you mentioned, right, attacks on the continent have increased significantly, fivefold, actually, since AFRICOM was established in 2008. And militant groups, right, like ISIS or al-Shabaab in Somalia and al-Qaeda are actually products of the destabilization caused by U.S. wars, Western wars, and occupation in Africa and the so-called Middle East. and the U.S. military its activities continue to grow.
With the U.S. military facing accusations of perpetrating crimes against the people of Africa and failing to combat terrorism, Russia is increasingly being seen as an alternative. More African countries are looking towards Russia to defeat terrorist groups that have flourished during U.S. military presence in the continent.
Now, our last question to you, Mr. Osazua. Will such a move lead to increased U.S. military presence in Africa to counter the Russians and indeed the Chinese?
Yeah, well, Russia and China offer an alternative to U.S. imperialism, U.S. full-spectrum dominance, and that allows African countries, African states, a small amount of space to exercise more effective national sovereignty than, you know, they'd ever really been afforded by the European or Western colonial powers that carved up and unmercifully exploited them and their labor and land. And so what we've seen from the military really is the implementation of AFRICOM, right, which is the U.S. response to political, economic, and in some cases military competition with Russia and China and those countries and increased influence on the continent. So what we know is that the U.S. and its allies kind of lack the capacity to mount, you know, true investments on the African continent that are conducive to its economic and social development.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde Osazua, for your great insight. Now, we take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about medical brain drain in Nigeria. So stay with us.
Nigeria's medical brain drain.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The Nigerian Medical Association says over 9,000 medical doctors left the country in search of greener pastures in the United Kingdom, United States of America, and Canada in 2 years.
The association says the exodus of the medical experts, which happened between 2016 and 2018, negatively impacted the nation's healthcare system, and that only 4.7% of specialists were left to take care of Nigerians' health issues.
A Nigerian medical doctor elaborates here on the dire situation the country faces following the medical brain drain.
For you to understand that properly, you could just go to any outpatient department in any government institution and see the crowds that are waiting to see a single doctor in a day, you know, and you don't expect the best out of that doctor.
Now, to discuss more on this medical brain drain, we have invited Joseph Ochieno, an African affairs commentator. Thanks a lot for joining us. Now, we know thousands of Nigerian doctors have left the country to work in Europe and North America. What's your opinion on the real reason behind this massive medical brain drain?
Quite clearly, the answer lies in the economics of medical supplies. Most of the countries where these Nigerian doctors are going to need health workers, and they can pay well. While it is the case in Nigeria and across Africa that most of the medical workers, highly trained, by the way, are not able to find decent jobs at home, most of these countries are providing them opportunities for good employment good facilities, opportunities to train and up their skills, good wages, good working conditions, higher level pensions.
The president of the Nigerian Medical Association, Professor Innocent Yuja, has lamented that brain drain in the health sector is overstretching the few medical personnel left behind in government-owned hospitals. He made the remarks early April in the country's capital, Abuja, during an annual meeting whose theme was brain drain and medical tourism, the twin evil in Nigeria's health system. He said the association will take the lead in addressing the crisis.
The national discourse on brain drain and medical tourism is therefore inevitable at this time, and it's only right, just, and appropriate for Nigerian Medical Association to take the lead, being the leader of the health team.
How is the medical brain drain impacting on the country's health system, and how serious is the crisis?
So, you know, it's impacting on the health of these nations. It's impacting on the economies of these nations. It's impacting on the social services generally and social impacting on these countries. And it's impacting on the possibilities, which is basically a national security problem for these countries. A country like Nigeria, very, very big country with a huge population, the largest country on the African continent, but a country which is also still very substantially poor. You know, poor health services, poor health education. You know very well that you're actually building, you know, a population which is bigger in numbers, but a burden to the nation long term. So brain drain in Africa generally is a big problem. But when it comes to medical services and education, it is really, really a very big problem. As I said earlier, I think governments need to take rapid measures to be able to make sure that they're able to stem the brain drain. But as I said, there's hope. I know a number of doctors, a number of specialist doctors in Europe and perhaps even in Southern Africa, because some actually go to South Africa, they are willing to stay home or to return to the continent if only the current pay bargains are basically mildly doubled, which is possibly not a lot. Many of them are willing to return if, you know, state policies are such that, you know, they're reasonably improved. But I think government still continue to spend a lot on security. Generally, of course, these days they're spending on infrastructure, but mainly the infrastructure programs will be about roads, some big roads which necessarily are not impacting on the health of the nation.
Africa, alongside other developing countries, continues to experience a net medical brain drain for decades. A report for the UK's House of Commons last year found that 38% of hospital doctors in the National Health Service gained their qualifications outside the UK. 168,000 NHS staff reported a non-British nationality. This figure understates medical migration by failing to include those who qualified abroad but are now British citizens by ancestry or naturalization.
The medical brain drain in Nigeria and indeed in other African countries has been referred to as a crime being perpetrated by high-income Western countries. Mr. Otieno, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it's actually a crime against humanity. You know, I see in Uganda, many young women, you know, professionals, you know, lining up and queuing up simply to go and do very basic cleaning jobs that do not need equivalent ordinary level education to do these jobs. But people go there because of the state of the economies of these African countries. The lure of basically visiting these new nations abroad. And as I said, general conditions, terms and conditions that most of these countries provide. But that is much more towards health workers. As I said, I know many nurses who are willing to go and do cleaning jobs in Europe, or many nurses who are willing to go and become work as health care assistants in health facilities, and their pays will be better than those pays of specialist doctors. But let me tell you this.
Now, the medical workers living in Africa are being blamed for disloyalty to countries that spend fortunes educating them. But this Nigerian doctor says many are forced to leave due to deplorable working conditions.
The working conditions for health care professionals in this country are quite deplorable. The pay, equipment and facilities to manage to diagnose patients and manage them effectively are generally lacking in most health institutions across the country. This in itself is enough for one after a lot of years of rigorous training to seek greener pastures elsewhere. It's not just seeking greener pastures, but the job satisfaction also is generally lacking in Nigeria.
I have another question to Ms. Ucheno. Now, do you think African doctors should stay home and serve their people despite the low salaries they get?
You know, I think it's absolutely unfair to say that they're being disloyal. This is a reality of globalization. An aspect of this is also the negative impact of globalization, as it were. But on the other hand, it is the responsibility of policymakers on the African continent, governments on the African continent. I think the responsibility lies with the state. I believe in a big, I'm a democratic left socialist, as it were. But I think any sensible person should be able to rationalize this process that, look, you know, when it comes to some of these things, market forces apply. And if it's market forces simply because of convenience in terms of your skill, ability to earn a living, and the need to express your skill, so be it. But I also want to tell you, anyway, that having been said, some of these brain drains impact positively on the home countries, not in terms of health provisions, but in terms of remittances back onto the continent. In Uganda's case, remittance the other financial year was the second largest foreign exchange earner after Kofi.
The WHO Code of Practice on International Recruitment adopted to tackle brain drain is being ignored. Adopted in 2010, the WHO Global Code of Practice on the International Recruitment of Health Personnel seeks to strengthen understanding and ethical management of international health personnel recruitment through improved data, information, and international cooperation.
Mr. Ucheno, my last question to you. Now, what needs to be done to enforce this code of practice and save African health systems from an imminent crisis of staff shortages?
You know, when it comes to global conventions, you know, you're in Tehran, you know, when the UN wants to act, they will act rather decisively. Many of these global institutions, especially those associated with Bretton Woods institutions, they will act and they will be ensure that systems work if it serves the interests of the West. On this occasion, these ethical codes really to protect, you know, emerging young nations like Uganda, like Nigeria, you know, emerging nations like struggling nations like Zimbabwe. But the key recipients are the privileged Saudi Arabia, the privileged United States, the privileged Britain and Ireland. And, you know, the Brits are very good with propaganda on this. And I was just looking at some statistics. You know, the net recipients, followed by Ireland and to an extent Saudi Arabia, in receiving many of these doctors, and they will be delighted to receive many of these health workers.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Ucheno, for your insight. We hope African governments will take proper steps to retain the continent's medical workers. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today we are going to talk more about perhaps a political issue, or at least a sentence that many Muslims have heard, especially Muslims who live in non-Islamic, countries. And the perhaps sentence or question is as follows: not all Muslims are terrorists, but why are all terrorists Muslims?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First part of the question is absolutely right. I want to say that the, Muslims are not terrorists. But the second part of it, with some observation, even into the first sentence.
Right.
But after all, you find in other, I want to say that some people, they are not even, maybe they do not have any religion, and maybe they are not Muslim even, but they are terrorists.
Right.
I just want to refer to the, some people like, for example, Zionist,
yes,
groups and government, and the American government.
Right.
These are a symbol of the terrorism. Please look at the history of America and how many war invaded and waged war against many countries and against many people. More than thousands of people have been massacred and killed by the American invasions.
Right.
For example, look at the Iraq, look at Afghanistan, and some other countries. By the invasion of America, they have been killed, they have been massacred.
Yes.
A lot of injured people,
right,
inflicted with the different problems.
Also, European countries, the Sheikh, who colonized Africa and parts of Asia. So you're saying, in essence, that terrorism, because when they say terrorism, they do not mean the government, they do not mean a country, they mean a single organization. But that organization, in our viewpoint, right, Sheikh, it can be a country as well, a government as well.
Yes, of course. Even some individual or some government. Look at the invasion of Israel into the Palestinian
Zionist
people.
Regime.
Yes.
Yes, worse than the Nazis themselves.
You see in the news that each and every day they kill many Palestinian people.
Right.
Innocent people who are fasting, in the holy month of Ramadan and before and after that, killing innocent girls and boys.
So many atrocities you can find, but nobody speaks about it in Western media, unfortunately.
Nobody speaks about that. Please look at the, as I said, the history of American invasion, like the war of Vietnam.
Yeah, not even from non-American sources. Just look at American sources. So you cannot say that we are biased. Just look at American history and you'll see, like, the American nation was founded in blood.
Exactly.
The Revolutionary War, and after that, the Civil War, and blood by blood and blood.
Yeah, please, my dear listener, as my dear host said, I do not want to seem biased because I'm Iranian. I just, seem to be against the American. No.
Right.
Look at the history of America. Please look at only the War of Vietnam.
Right.
How many people they have been massacred and killed brutally in
right.
that war?
Use weapons that weren't used before, like napalm, new weapons, and
yes,
bombing villages. And of course, we need, goes without saying, we talk about the government and those who stand with the troops and soldiers. Because if you remember, Sheikh, there were also some demonstrations against the war in Vietnam as well, in America.
Yeah.
So just to clarify for our listeners, we don't talk about all Americans. We need this clarification, unfortunately.
Of course.
We talk about the army, those who participate in the war, the government, those we are against.
Of course, we are talking about the American, administration.
Authorities,
right, as yes, you mentioned. Yes, you're right. And who sent and who equipped the Saudi with a lot of equipment,
weapons and munitions, airplanes to bomb Yemen.
To bomb Yemen.
Yes.
This is a big question.
Or who armed the Syrian rebels in Syria? They called them rebels, but then no, suddenly they were terrorist groups.
Who armed this terrorist group worldwide? This is a big question.
Right, yes. That's whenever, a more general question.
Whenever you find any rebels, whenever you find any, you know, troops fighting the other innocent people, you find, you know, whether American or Zionist group or other European countries.
You find a Western hand in it.
Western hand in it. They equip and they send weapons toward them and they want to arm them against the innocent people. I just wondering why some people, they ignore such a crime, big crimes in front of the eyes of the public, but they look at the some of the ideas, of course, which was by the media broadcast by the media against the Muslim
media propaganda, very normal
media propaganda, and you know, causing this Islamophobia.
Exactly, yes.
This is I think the agenda of some of the Western media against political Islam, against the real Islam. I want to say that most of the, you know, accusation comes and stems from this media agenda and media propaganda against Muslim and against Islam. But after all, I have to mention this point that within Islamic, let's say, religion and denomination, we have some extremist groups like Takfiri groups who really defame the Muslim community and Islamic Ummah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
These Takfiri groups, you can find them, you know, somewhere in some countries by different names and titles.
Right.
They are, you know, killing people, massacring innocent people, unfortunately, by the name of Islam. And these groups, you know, if you go to the origin of that, maybe one of the, you know, you can find some Western countries and America, American administration, who founded these groups, you know, to some extent.
Them, at least, funded them, gave them weapons, equipment, money.
Yes. Right. I want to say that you can find the hand of the Western, some of the Western countries for the, you know, funding these groups and the, you know, having this group against the humanity.
Right.
But you see that we cannot say that, for example, Muslim are terrorists or such ideas. Unfortunately, some people are under the influence of the media. And I understand that when you look at the heavy propaganda against Muslim and against, you know, Islamic Ummah, you would find this perspective toward the Muslim.
Right. So in essence, what we are trying to say here, dear Sheikh, is that first, our dear listeners, they should look at the term terrorist, see what it entails, and perhaps realize that it cannot only refer to organizations and groups, but it can also refer to countries. Because these countries that you've mentioned, and the history, you can find it online as well. You do not need to go to the history books. They, in essence, they're also big terrorist countries or terrorist governments. So it is wrong for somebody to come here and then say, and ask and say, well, all terrorists, they're Muslims. That is simply not true. We do also have rebel groups in some African countries. We do have some rebel groups in Africa. They are Christian rebel terrorist groups. The Zionist regime, they are Zionist terrorist groups in Israel, occupied Palestine. We can mention so many examples. So a terrorist, Sheikh, they're not just an organization or a group of Muslim people. they are also countries. Is that a correct understanding?
Yeah, exactly. I want to say that we cannot attribute such terrorist act to the specific religion.
Right.
When you find, for example, as you mentioned, some Christian doing that or some Jew people doing that.
Nobody says that's Christianity and Judaism.
Judaism, right. Yeah. It is a false, and the I want to say that the weak point of that individual or group.
Right.
We do not ascribe it to the Christianity or Judaism.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
Or, for example, the Buddhist. You see in the in
what
the
they did
news.
In Myanmar and
yeah,
all
yeah.
of those
exactly.
The Rohingya Muslims, I believe they were called the...
Yeah.
They took their villages, burned their villages, killed them, killed their children, but nobody talks about that.
Yeah, exactly. This is a point that when we talk about the some so-called Muslim, they attribute themselves to the divine religion of Islam and they
right.
practice some terrorist action, we cannot say it is a fault of the religion.
Exactly.
Because...
Yeah.
These people are deviated from the mainstream, religion. They deviated from the right path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The
and they ignored,
of Islam.
Yes, they ignored the teaching of Quran and the teaching of Islam.
Right.
They have the facade of religion.
Yes.
You know, they seem to be, they, show themselves to be Muslim, but unfortunately,
right.
They are not.
Of course,
they are not
Muslims.
Practicing Muslims.
Yeah, why? If you see the primary victims of these terrorist organizations, they are Muslims. Now, the bombings in Iraq and Pakistan recently, what is happening in Afghanistan, the victims of these terrorist organizations are Muslims. So you need to ask yourself, why would a Muslim kill a Muslim? Is it the teachings of Islam? No, of course not. So I would say to our dear listeners who have heard these questions or thinking these thoughts, find out what Islam is, the true Islam, and then you for yourselves, you can measure whether what you've seen these Muslims do is Islam or not.
Exactly. You see, my dear brother, unfortunately, the problem that we are suffering from nowadays is a lack of sufficient knowledge.
Right.
Some people, even within Islamic denomination, if they practice such, horrendous actions against humanity. I'm talking about these takfiri groups who excommunicate all Muslims to be out of the realm of Islam. Unfortunately, the most problem of that is related to the lack of information and knowledge about Islam.
Right.
They think that the teachings of Ibn Taymiyyah is an end of story.
Yes.
We cannot say anything, above that.
Right.
But the reality is that you can find a lot of weak points, a lot of misunderstanding in the books of Ibn Taymiyyah.
Exactly. Yeah.
And those people who just want to follow up these, teachings of Ibn Taymiyyah and the founder of Wahhabiyat and Wahhabiyya, and they do not have further study about Islam. They do not have further study, enough study about the divine
right.
religion of Islam. So I invite all my listeners and other fellow Muslim brothers and sisters to have enough study and to be away from ignorance.
And on that note, we will have to end today's session because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sheikh for joining us today and for answering this very annoying question. And I also thank the dear listeners for sticking throughout with us. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن حسن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper writes in new memoir of how worried he was that President Donald Trump would try to use military to hold on to power. We now present you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Defense Secretary Says I Warned U.S. National Guard of Possible Coup. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A week before Election Day in 2020, the U.S. Secretary of Defense was so worried that President Donald Trump would seek to involve the military in the election in an attempt to hold on to power, he told the general commanding of the U.S. National Guard to notify him of any communication from anyone at all at the White House. Mark Esper writes in a new memoir, without being too explicit, "My message was clear. The U.S. military was not going to get involved in the election, no matter who directed it. I would intercede." Mark Esper writes, "Such an intercession would involve trying to persuade Donald Trump not to use the military to hold on to power. Then, if necessary, Esper would resign, appeal to Republicans in Congress, and hold a press conference to appeal to the American people directly." Mark Esper thought Donald Trump might order actions such as seizing ballot boxes in key states. Ultimately, Donald Trump did not attempt to use the military to influence the election, which he lost to Joe Biden. He did seek to overturn the results of the election by other means. Mark Esper was fired by Donald Trump on 9th of November 2020, just 6 days after the election. He details the extraordinary steps he felt compelled to take before that in a new book, A Second Oath, Memoirs of a Defense Secretary in Extraordinary Times, which will be published in the coming days. Mark Esper devotes considerable space to his work with General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to stymie Donald Trump's attempts to use the military for political purposes, either in military strikes against Syria or even Mexico, or at home, by invoking the Insurrection Act against protesters for racial justice. Donald Trump's request that such protesters be shot in the legs and Mark Esper's account of his resistance to it has been reported elsewhere. The protests died down, but Mark Esper says the two most senior Pentagon figures remained concerned that Donald Trump could seek to use the military domestically to tilt power his way. Mark Esper describes a meeting at the Pentagon with General Mark Milley and the National Guard Chief General Daniel Hawkinson on 30th of October, the last Friday before the election. Mark Esper says given it was visible to anyone who could see his calendar, the ostensible purpose of the meeting was an update on National Guard military police units placed on alert to placate Donald Trump during the protests for racial justice. But with regards to the election, Mark Esper